Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm glad you could join us. We had intended to talk today about the latest scientific thinking about how to effectively treat drug addiction. Our expert could not join us today, but if you're tuning in for that, we will have that conversation on Midday. We'll have it soon. So today we have a chance to talk about neighborhoods. Baltimore is said to be a city of neighborhoods, and a new report takes that to heart. The Baltimore Neighborhood Indicators Alliance has tracked a variety of quality of life measures in city neighborhoods since 2001. The data is intended to provide insight into the overall trajectory of each of these neighborhoods. We'll take a look at the Baltimore neighborhoods by the numbers. Dr. Seema Iyer, who oversees the alliance, will join us later in the hour to talk about how you paint a picture of a city with 8,000 data points. But up first, we'll hear about an event aimed at uniting some of those neighborhoods. This Saturday is the 9th annual Boundary Block Party, organized by Jubilee Arts and the No Boundaries Coalition. The coalition is led by residents and works to cross boundaries of race, class, and neighborhoods in central West Baltimore. And here with me to talk about the event, to tell us about this block party day after tomorrow, is Rebecca Nagel, the No Boundaries Coalition coordinator. Rebecca Nagel began organizing the block party in 2007. Welcome.
Thank you for having us.
And also here with us is Sandtown Winchester resident Marlene Brown, who hopes to use the event this Saturday to help increase voter turnout. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
So, Rebecca, you've been working at this for several years. Describe this event, the block party, and what it's how it works, what it was like.
So the block party is actually how the No Boundaries Coalition started. So before there was a community organization, there was an annual block party. And the idea was to bring residents together across race and class, which is why it's called the Boundary Block Party, to come together and build relationships. After the third annual block party, about 25 of us, many people who are still involved in the coalition, gathered together in the basement of a church and over dinner talked about what do people want to see happen besides just a block party. And that conversation actually founded the No Boundaries Coalition. We've grown into a resident-led advocacy organization. We're working on police accountability, public safety, increasing access to healthy food, specifically produce, and opportunities for young people. And we still do the block party every spring.
And I'm interested in all of those important efforts that you're involved in. But tell us first about the party. What happens at this party?
So we're partnering with Jubilee Arts, which is a local community organization, an arts center. And so there's going to be performances from them, art making tables. Two local marching bands are going to perform, actually march through the neighborhood to the block party. There's going to be food. And most importantly, there are going to be free shuttles to early voting sites. So everyone who comes can get a free ride to the polls.
And you have segued beautifully to what I want to talk to Marlene about, which is, okay, how do you connect a block party to a civic duty like voting?
Well, we're going to have booths set up, and we have all the information needed for early voting, the sites. We'll have people there to explain to people that are not yet registered how they can register and actually vote that same day. We will have vans available to take them to the sites and get their voting done that particular date and time.
Did you pick the date of this block party specifically to fall within early voting? Because early voting starts today.
Correct.
So it's not just something you can jawbone about on Saturday. People can actually vote. Was that part of picking this date?
Correct.
These heads are bobbing up and down. You can't see this on the radio, but they're very enthusiastic about the fact that they have glommed into the only weekend, the only Saturday when people can vote is your party. But I mean, come on, people come to a party to party. Do you really think people are going to be interested in busing over to vote?
Well, once we get them there, we're going to do everything we can to get them over to that information booth and relay what important information it is and to let them know how important it is to register and those that already registered to actually vote. This is an important election time, and it's very important for people to vote.
About how many people come to the block party?
We usually get about 1,000 people.
And do you have any idea, Marlene Brown, how many of them are registered?
Not actual information, but I think there'll be a large number who will not be registered. And also those who are not going to be aware that they can register and go directly to vote. And there will be some, even now that it's possible for felons to vote. I think that kind of information needs to be put out there, and I think there'll be a lot of people surprised at that.
And this year, at early voting sites, people can register and vote the same day. So on April 26th, if you're not yet registered to vote, you cannot vote on that day. But today through April 21st, at all early voting sites, people can register and vote the same day.
So it kind of breaks through the deadline of a couple of weeks ago to register. This is kind of a revisit of that. If you didn't
Correct.
Register and thought, oh, shoot, I forgot to register,
Correct.
You can if you vote early.
Exactly. And we've been out, I mean, we've been registering folks to vote since July. So we've been canvassing, we've been in high schools, we have voting block captains who've signed up their neighbors to vote, like Miss Marlene's block. And we'll, through early voting and through the election, be helping take people to the polls, getting the word out, and doing everything we can to double voter turnout.
Last year, the block party took place just after the violence and the unrest. What was that like?
Well, we had a large turnout then also. And I think that was helpful to have the block party at that particular time to actually continue with it and to let the community know that there is hope and there are people there willing to help get this community together, for us to come together and make something out of Sandtown and other surrounding neighborhoods.
Rebecca, your job is to coordinate this and a lot of other activities by the No Boundaries Coalition. How do you make sure that it truly is inclusive, that it doesn't isn't a small core of active people, but it really hits the range of people who live in these disparate neighborhoods?
So we do a lot of listening. So in the past year, we have, through community meetings, through what we call one-on-ones, where we sit down and talk with someone for about 30 to 45 minutes, and also through house meetings, which is gathering a group of about 8 to 15 leaders. In just the past year, we've talked to 1,000 residents from 21217 directly. And so,
is that the zip code that covers does that cover the entire No Boundaries coalition area?
Yeah. So the 8 neighborhoods that we work in are in 21217. And so we don't move, we don't act, we don't do anything until we've listened to a large number of people. And then when we're out listening to folks, we're also identifying leaders, we're inviting people to our meetings. We do a lot of leadership development. So just at our last meeting, we did a media training, because the press are going to be in the neighborhoods a lot the next month. And so we wanted to talk to people about how to do interviews with press. So we focus a lot on leadership development, and all of our initiatives come out of listening. So last year, before the unrest, the Saturday that there was that large protest that actually went through Sandtown, 20 volunteers from the No Boundaries Coalition went and door knocked, and we actually talked to about 250 Sandtown residents in just that day. And so before we responded to everything that was going on in the neighborhood, we took the time to go out and to really listen to people.
That's Rebecca Nagel, coordinator of the No Boundaries Coalition here on Midday on WYPR. Also with us is Miss Marlene Brown, a Sandtown Winchester resident who intends to use the activities of this weekend to get people to focus on voting and, in fact, to get them to vote. I'm very intrigued by the intense listening you do. Tell me what you're hearing these days in that part of the city? I mean, what is on people's minds? How are people feeling about the prospects and where things are heading? Whether there's a new direction?
We still need to convince the residents that there is hope and there is help available, and people are coming together more than what they did in the past to listen and to let their thoughts be known and their feelings be known, because they see there are people there ready to listen to their side of the story and the things that they want to happen and the things that they want to see done in their community, for them to make decisions and not have other people come in and make decisions for them. So this is something that has been happening now, and this is what you get when you talk with people. Now, you know, we want to have a voice in what goes on in our community.
Well, and do you pick up that people do feel they have a voice? Or, I mean, are you picking up more frustration or more positive energy?
I think there's still a lot of frustration out there. I think there is still a lot of frustration and a feeling that they're not really trusting that change is coming. They really don't. It's a lot of people that don't trust, because, you know, this has happened before, and where did it go and what did we get, you know, kind of an attitude.
Rebecca.
I was just going to say that I think that in all of the, as an outside observer, what I've witnessed is a lot of people talking about Sandtown, but not really taking the time to talk to Sandtown. Mm-hmm. So the press and everybody who's wanting to talk about this neighborhood, I hear people who are frustrated who aren't being asked questions and aren't being asked what they think.
So, and this is, you think, true of local press as well as national press? Because I assume the national press is swooping in to do 1 year later stories. So you feel that, but what I'm asking you, Rebecca Nagel, what you raised, what you pick up as a frustration in how the press is addressing this.
So that day that we went out door knocking, you know, there were so many people in Sandtown that day. So there was a ton of press. There was a ton of media. Elected officials were there. Protesters were there. And when we were out door knocking, one of the things we heard over and over again was, you know, this group is the first group of people that has asked me what I think. This is the first time that somebody's asked me my opinion and what I think about what's going on. And amidst, you know, everything that was going on in the neighborhood, when we were asking, you know, the question we asked people when we went door knocking was, what feels urgent to you? And the biggest thing that we heard was to be heard, you know. And so then we followed up on that. We had a town hall with the city council president and the heads of different government agencies. And we did a lot of organizing in partnership with Jubilee Arts around youth jobs helped organize funding for their Art at Work program. And so we followed up on that as an organization. But I think that a year later, that's still a theme of just residents feeling like their voice matters and that they're being heard.
Correct.
So how does all this, Marlene Brown, how does all this relate then to voting?
I think it relates to voting, because if we do not get out and vote people in office that we feel are going to listen to us and to carry on some of the things and suggestions that the people who live in the area want done, then we're going to be lost. And I think there are some people out there that are willing to do that. And if we do not get out and vote for those people, then we're going to be in trouble.
But what is it? What is the main reason you hear when you talk to people about why they don't vote? If they're not planning to vote, what do they tell you?
The main reason is, why vote? They're not going to do anything. They haven't done anything in the past. That's the main reason. I'll just be wasting my time. There's not going to be a change.
And you say, what's your pitch?
And I say, that is not true. I said, you don't know the power that you have in that vote. And that vote gives you a voice, and that vote makes you available and heard to these politicians that you vote for and elect and put in office. They are accountable to you once you get out and vote and let your vote be counted.
So we've talked about the party. The block party starts day after tomorrow, Saturday. Starts at noon, runs till 4. What else should people know that about what No Boundaries Coalition is working on in the near term?
So we also are running a community-run produce stall every Saturday from 9 a.m. to sell out, which is usually about 2 or 3 p.m. at the Pennsylvania Avenue Public Market. And so people can come there to actually shop and purchase fresh and healthy produce. It's all volunteer-run, so people on our website can also sign up to volunteer. And this Saturday, since we're doing the block party, we're actually moving the produce stand that's at the Avenue Market up north a few blocks, so it'll be at the block party. So people who are coming to the block party can also do their weekend grocery shopping.
So people can party, shop, and vote.
Correct.
In one stop.
Correct.
Day after tomorrow on Saturday. One last question before I let you go. Are you picking up, because, I mean, I've been hearing about the No Boundaries Coalition for several years now, and this is the 9th annual block party, right? Are you picking up that other parts of the city are looking to do the same kinds of things? Are there other coalitions turning to you for advice?
I don't know of any that really are doing that. I mean, do you know of any?
I think there are other groups. You know, we partner a lot with other groups like Build or the Campaign for Job Safety and Justice. So there are a lot of groups that are also working on getting out the vote, increasing access to healthy food. So we partner with a lot of citywide initiatives. And for a lot of the things that we want to see change, like, you know, police accountability, those are citywide reforms. And some of them are state laws
reforms
that need to change. Yes. And so we can't just have residents from 21217 fighting for those changes. We really need to work with other groups in the city and in the state.
Correct. Well, I really appreciate your giving us an idea of what your coalition is working on. And I hope you have a great time on Saturday.
I'm sure we will.
I want to thank you both. Rebecca Nagel from the No Boundaries Coalition, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Sandtown Winchester resident Marlene Brown, thank you.
Thank you.
The 9th annual Boundary Block Party, but it's No Boundaries.
Uh-huh. So the story of that is the Boundary Block Party started on Utah Place, which was a racial dividing line in Central West Baltimore. And then when we had that house meeting, people said, well, it's been the Boundary Block Party, but our goal is to break these boundaries down. So let's call ourselves the No Boundaries Coalition.
Gotcha. So the Boundary Block Party, the 9th annual Boundary Block Party, day after tomorrow, Saturday, April 16th, from noon to 4 p.m. at Pennsylvania Avenue and Pressman Street. The neighborhood will host a variety of free arts events and workshops in coming weeks as well to mark the anniversary of the unrest a year ago. More information on the Midday page at WYPR. .org. Thank you again. We've taken a quick break now, and when we come back, we'll meet Seema Iyer. Since 2011, she's overseen the Baltimore Neighborhood Indicators Alliance, which collects quality of life data about Baltimore by looking into the city's 55 community statistical areas. What can we learn from this meticulous approach? In your life, how important is your neighborhood? What does it mean to you? Can you imagine living anywhere else? Call us at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cast. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Sheila Cast. Which of Baltimore's neighborhoods are growing and which are shrinking? How do commute times vary for residents across the city? How can data about communities inform policy and improve the quality of life? Tracking quality of life measures for Baltimore's neighborhoods has been the mission of the Baltimore Neighborhoods Indicators Alliance and the Jacob France Institute for more than a decade. This is the 13th edition of the Vital Signs Report. We're now on Vital Signs 14, and today we'll talk about all the bits of information in Vital Signs 14, how they fit together, everything from the high school completion rate, Washington Village Pigtown ranked number 1 in that category, to the percentage of people whose commutes are 45 minutes long or longer. Sandtown, Winchester tops that list. 34% of Sandtown residents spend more than 45 minutes getting to work. Dr. Seema Iyer, Associate Director of the Jacob France Institute in the University of Baltimore's Merrick School of Business. She has overseen the Baltimore Neighborhood Indicators Alliance since 2011, tracking various quality of life measures to provide insight about the overall trajectory of different areas. And Seema Iyer joins us today to talk about the latest report. Welcome back to Midday, Seema.
Thank you so much.
You have overseen the Baltimore Neighborhood Indicators Alliance since 2011, but you worked on it before that, right? I seem to remember interviewing you about it years ago.
I used to be the chief of research for the planning department for Baltimore City, and in that role, I used to serve on the steering committee for the Baltimore Neighborhood Indicators Alliance. So I've quietly been watching for the entire time that I've been in Baltimore, which is about 12 years.
Okay, so, I mean, there really is an enormous amount of data that you have just unveiled, and it's probably not fair to ask you this, but that's what reporters do. Is there a headline? Is there some overarching finding that either surprised you or confirmed something you'd been watching for a while? Or is there a headline here?
Absolutely. Every year it does kind of reveal itself as we're writing kind of what the real headline is, and, you know, the research that we normally do over the course of a year. But the headline is that, like many other metropolitan cities around the country, Baltimore is becoming much more of a renter city. So the owner occupancy rate in the city of Baltimore is declining, going down from around 60% just in 2010, now down to about 56%. And those, it might seem like a small percentage, but that's a lot more households that are eventually becoming renter households. So home ownership versus renter, getting to deal with how these two types of households and two types of property owners really can get along in one neighborhood is what I think we want to push neighborhoods to really keep track of in the next couple of years. Is your home ownership rate going down too far? Like, is it turning over too fast? That could be discombobulating for some neighborhoods. If it's kind of going down slowly, that kind of matches the citywide trend. If you're going in the opposite direction, where you're having an increase in homeowner occupancy, where the city's actually going down, you're kind of bucking the trend. What does that mean?
Is that happening in some places?
There are a couple of neighborhoods. Claremont Armistead was the one that actually showed the greatest increase in home ownership. Claremont Armistead is on the northeast part of town, where there's a lot of new construction of housing.
I should tell listeners that Dr. Seema Iyer is sitting here with no notes. She's got all this in her head, and it's very impressive. So if there's something where she says, can't quite remember that number, you should give her a pass. I'm about to ask you now, which neighborhoods are you seeing the sharpest decline in home ownership?
I wouldn't necessarily say sharpest, but just in general, there are some neighborhoods that are well below the citywide average in home ownership in general. Madison East End on the east side of town has, 30 to 40% owner occupancy, and it is unfortunately going down, even though it's below the citywide average of 56. So just understanding how far away you are, that means that the vast majority of people living in that neighborhood are renters, which, again, is not a good or bad thing. It's just neighborhoods have to deal with the property owners for renters. Is it one property owner in a big mixed family income unit, or is it multiple family owners, property owners that have multiple renters? Bel Air Edison is the case where you have lots of home owners in an otherwise stable neighborhood that got really swept up in the last couple of years in the foreclosure crisis. And now many of those homeowners are underwater. The average sales price in Bel Air Edison is unfortunately around $55,000 to $60,000 a year. So if you happen to have purchased that house, perfectly decent row home in Bel Air Edison, for more than that, you're actually not going to get a selling price to match kind of what you paid for it. And so a lot of people are turning to renting.
And as you said, underwater means that your mortgage may be higher than what you could sell your house for now.
Exactly. And so a lot of, mom and pop homeowners are turning to the rental market just to make an income off their asset. And so depending on your neighborhood, if renters means that you've got, big apartment complexes with the property management that's taking care of the entire building, that's different than if you've got an entire row home block where 50% are individual homeowners that are renting out their properties. And neighborhoods know this. Neighborhoods know kind of which homeowner property owners are taking care of their property, even if it's a renter. So just noticing the changes that are happening in your neighborhood is what the vital signs is all about.
And I want to make sure that I'm understanding precisely what this finding is. When you say 56% of occupied homes in Baltimore
owner are now occupied homes.
Mm-hmm. Are owner occupied, and that's down by about 4 percentage points from where it was a few years ago. You're not saying that's a change in occupancy. You're not saying increase in vacancy. You're saying these homes people are living in, but fewer people who own the home are living here.
Vacancy is actually a different indicator, which we can talk about too.
Right. Well, I wanted to because you highlight three goals, and two of them have to do with shelter. One is that you say there's a need for diversity in housing. Explain what that goal means.
So if we know that you're going to have different types of households, you know, different sizes, we have single family, we have single person, you have families with kids, families without kids, and you have different incomes, the way to get at diversity in your neighborhood is actually to have a diversity in your housing stock. You know, if you have some rental units, if you have some townhouses, if you have some single family homes, those are all going to be at different price points, and then therefore affordable for people at different income levels. And once you get to that level of diversity, it's the best outcome for children in a neighborhood where there's a diversity of experience, a diversity of income, and then hopefully a diversity of incomes of the children attending the school. Once you have a uniform and homogenous housing stock, especially if the housing stock is all low income, the only children that you're going to see in your school are all low income children, becomes a very difficult milieu within which to mm-hmm. kind of educate in that setting. So if we get to diversity in the housing stock in every neighborhood and keep monitoring that, and we actually came up with another indicator this year in Vital Signs 14 that's new. It comes from the United States Department of Urban Development, and the indicator is how many people in your neighborhood can take a housing choice voucher, which is a subsidized voucher to ensure that you don't spend more than 30% of your income on your housing. How many people can use that voucher in your neighborhood? And in the city, the average rate, we have 131 housing choice vouchers for every 1,000 rental units in the city of Baltimore. And now you can actually check how close to that citywide average is your neighborhood. How far off are you? Some things to note in Bel Air Edison, we talked about that people are turning to renters. The housing choice voucher utilization is very, very high in Bel Air Edison, and something that we have to keep monitoring. And the folks in Bel Air Edison,
above the city average.
Well above the city average. It's almost 400 per 1,000 units, where the citywide average is 131. Conversely, you have other neighborhoods where the rate is incredibly low. And so if you have a housing choice voucher, you can't seem to use it in your neighborhood. And what can you do as a neighborhood to potentially change that?
Make it more welcome to people who would be getting that kind of housing
help.
So your second goal is to essentially set a goal or reduce, let me just read it precisely, reduce or maintain vacant and abandoned housing below 4% in every neighborhood. Is 4% the citywide average of vacants?
We did a little bit of research. We have another report on our website called kind of What Happened in Baltimore Neighborhoods in the Last Year. And we found that no neighborhood was able to at least remain stable in terms of population or grow if they had more than 4% vacant and abandoned housing. So there seems to be a tipping point where people are not moving in. More people are not moving in than are moving out of a neighborhood once your neighborhood has 4 out of 100 homes that are vacant and abandoned, boarded up.
And how many Baltimore neighborhoods are above that measure?
Nearly half are above 4%. The citywide average is 8.1%, and it grew a little bit between 2013 and 2014. So it went from 8% to 8.1%. So there's a bunch of neighborhoods that are in that 5, 6, 7, 8, 9% range. which the city's vacants to value program is actually working really well in those types of neighborhoods where it's not so far away from 4%. But the number one neighborhood in 2014 for vacant and abandoned housing was Sandtown Winchester at 35%. Well above 4 and
35% of Sandtown Winchester's
got a vacant and abandoned house notice on it. And that translates, and if we're talking about scale, that translates to 2,300 to 2,400 properties.
So you're saying it's just very difficult for a neighborhood to be successful.
And this is a context that we have children going to school in. They're walking past 2,400 vacant and abandoned properties. And what we mention in the report is that if you think about it, vacant and abandoned properties is literally, by its name, property that other people abandoned. And literally, you can think about it like other people's trash. And this is what people are living with every day in a neighborhood like Sandtown Winchester.
So when you set a goal, it's probably not right to call it a goal because nobody's going to try to raise the number of vacants in any neighborhood to reach 4%. But when you say 4% is really as much as you can expect a neighborhood to cope with, what kind of advice then would you give? And I realize, you know, you're the data person. You're not necessarily spewing policies out about all this. But, you know, there's this plan that Governor Hogan announced that Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake described as demolition on steroids. How should your data inform the decisions they make about which vacants to pull down?
So, first of all, if you're a neighborhood below 4%, you should be monitoring this number. And that's the advice that I would give. If you're below 4%, you want to stay below 4%. Make sure that if there's any vacancy that comes up in your neighborhood, like attack it quickly because you don't want it to go. If you're between 4 and 10%, demolition may not necessarily be what your neighborhood needs. Maybe rehabilitation is realistic. You can count the number of properties that there are, and maybe we can work on a rehabilitation strategy. If you're above 10%, and if demolition truly is something that your community believes will be a way to reduce the supply of vacant and abandoned housing, those neighborhoods should and can and will work together to come up with that vision. Come up with a vision as a neighborhood of what a 4% or less neighborhood might look like. We actually gave that number to Pimlico, to Park Heights Renaissance. They were at 13.5%. And we said, hey, you know what? If you want to get below 4%, that's 380 homes. Which 380 homes do you want to work together to try and either rehabilitate or demolish? How do you want to work with the neighboring employers to make sure that if you rehabilitate, you've got a potential employee that might want to live near their work and actually occupy that property with a mortgage? So getting the credit to get a mortgage through one of the banks that are working with the neighborhood. And that's the kind of symbiotic relationship that hopefully the data can keep people across all sectors keeping track. Okay, well, this worked this year. We tried to rehabilitate this block, and you actually can see the vacancy go down. And we do have neighborhoods that are like that.
Sort of a reality check. Dale has called us from Greenmount West. Dale, welcome to Midday.
Good afternoon. I just wanted to say, while y'all were having your discussion, that I think one of the problems is that that's going to impact the abandonment problem as we go forward is the fact that we got a lot of population that actually own their houses, live in their houses, that are aging out of their properties because of age. And when they leave the houses by death or whatever, the houses, because they've been lived in 40, 50, 60 years without any upgrades, they don't have central air, the roof might need repair, they probably have lots of things that need to be fixed, that we're going to have a new cycle of abandonment because their relatives are not going to be able to, for the most part, are not going to have the wherewithal to fix up these properties to either turn it over to a relative or make it some kind of income-producing property. And I think that's part of why people abandon these properties. There were family members that actually lived in a lot of these properties that, for whatever reason, they got into a state of disrepair, and it's just like, you know, that ball just kept sliding and nobody could fix it. And then with some of the city policies like receivership and selective code enforcement, they're not helping the situation for people that have really tried to hold the city down. I supported receivership when it was first bought out as a solution, but it's taken a drastic turn from what it was intended to do to the outcomes that we're having now. So I think city policies extent are exacerbating problems.
Dale, interesting point you raise. I appreciate your calling. Thank you. What do you see in the data that relates to what Dale just raised?
Individual homeowners are making absolutely rational choices. Dale absolutely is correct that one of our biggest problems is when a house becomes what's called intestate. A person passes away and the beneficiary either might not know that they're a beneficiary or is nowhere near to actually maintain the property. One of the things that I teach real estate and economic development at the University of Baltimore, and what I tell my students is the number one thing you can do is to make sure that an elderly family member has a proper and accurate will, and everybody that is a beneficiary of that property knows the responsibility that they'll have to take on when and if they have to take over that house. But that house is sitting in a context, and that context has nothing to do with the individual owner. If a context is that, for example, the neighborhood is more than 4%, your neighborhood itself is
4%
not
4% vacant.
4% vacant. Your neighborhood itself is preventing people from being attracted to your individual home. And so the thing that we need to do for all homeowners is provide the right context. The market isn't going to function once your neighborhood crosses over 4%. We can see that in the data. People are choosing individually. You can even think for yourself. You're probably not going to choose a house in a high vacancy neighborhood because you're individually not going to get the equity on your home after 5 or 7 years when you choose to sell. So very rational choices, but the outcomes are neighborhood based.
We need to take a quick break here. Lots more to talk about with Dr. Seema Iyer. Since 2011, she's overseen the Baltimore Neighborhood Indicators Alliance, which is collecting quality of life data about Baltimore by looking at the 55 community statistical areas. What about you? What do you think? What is most important to you about your neighborhood? What makes you stick to your neighborhood, or what would you like to change about your neighborhood? You can be part of this conversation. You can send us an email at midday@wypr.org or phone us at 410-662-8780. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm speaking with Dr. Seema Iyer, Associate Director of the Jacob France Institute in the University of Baltimore's Merrick School of Business. She oversees the Baltimore Neighborhood Indicators Alliance, which tracks quality of life measures in Baltimore to provide insight into specific neighborhoods. BNIA just released a new report looking at data primarily from 2014, the most recent data that they can make sense of. And we've been talking about some of their conclusions and findings about housing. The other goal that you highlight in this report is reduce the percentage of households traveling more than 45 minutes to get to work. And as I mentioned, the top of that category is Santan Winchester. Something like a third of people in Santan Winchester travel more than 45 minutes to work.
Yes, exactly. What we found is that if you're going to choose an urban neighborhood, again, choosing kind of where you want to live, one of the reasons why you would do it is because you have access to something, whether it's your school, your job, walkability, access to retail. And so in neighborhoods where we have a lot of people that are traveling using the public transportation system, they end up having to travel more than 45 minutes to get to work. And that one indicator seems to be a real detriment to the neighborhood itself. Not only is it a problem for the household or the person that's doing the work, but two things can happen if you're traveling, if you have too many people in your neighborhood traveling that far. One is that, let's say you have a lot of people traveling that far to get to work and they're successful in keeping that job. The 45 minute is actually based on a lot of research that people start to get very unhappy after 45 minutes of commuting. And if they're successful
in
keeping
their...
This
is kind of a grumpy statistic.
It's a grumpy statistic. So if people are traveling that far and they're successful in keeping that job, they're probably most likely going
to
move.
To try to get...
To try and stay closer to their
shorter.
Job, exactly. Or if they're taking the public transportation system and they're not reliably getting to work every day, there's lots of variables that can happen if you're traveling more than 45 minutes to get to work, the likelihood of keeping that job becomes very low. And a lot of people get frustrated and end up remaining unemployed in your neighborhood. For the neighborhood itself, it's neither of those two outcomes is good. The successful person that kept the job is no longer in that neighborhood. Great for the person, not necessarily great for the neighborhood. the person that remains unemployed is not only, you know, unhappy themselves, but also living in the same neighborhood. So workforce training programs, we're trying to work with everybody that's working in this space to get people a job, very important to get a job. But can we have a conversation about reducing the commute time? Does that mean you're training people for jobs that are within the 45-minute commute shed? Can we get more jobs into the neighborhood? What would that look like if we got more jobs in the neighborhood? And these three goals actually feed off each other. One of the reasons why there aren't jobs in some of our low-income neighborhoods is because there isn't a diversity in the housing stock. Once you get a diversity in your housing stock, like I mentioned, you get a diversity in your income, the retail will come. And then you'll have more retail-based jobs, for example, as an entry level. So once we deal with all three of these indicators together, they'll actually start to feed off each other.
Obviously, the loss of plans for the Red Line sets back the goal. I mean, as I read the summary of the report, unlike vacants, where you set a standard of sort of 4%, the standard here is the 45 minutes. I don't know that you set a standard of this is the percentage of people commuting 45 minutes that a neighborhood can comfortably maintain.
Well, the citywide average is about 20% now. So just getting to the citywide average would be good. And remember, all of our indicators have both a numerator and a denominator. It's the number of their people and then the percentage of everybody that's working. So we can either get more jobs to the neighborhoods to reduce that commute time. We can make sure workforce training actually looks at, you know, how far away these jobs are when they're trying to train people to get to a particular job. So there's lots of strategies that you could do to even deal with that one kind of relatively simple indicator. And that's the point of the indicators. They're meant to be data that anybody can understand. A lot of people tell me, you know, I'm not a numbers person. But the minute we sit down and actually unpack what this number actually means, they get it. You can think about your own experience. Like, how far are you traveling? Think about your neighbors. Or how far are they traveling to get to work? Is this an issue that comes up when you have a community meeting, the fact that it's so far to get to work? People get it.
Who uses your data?
It is available online in multiple formats. It's available as an interactive website. The website is www.bniajfi.org.
And we will link to that from the midday page at WIPR.
And you can download the data yourself. Lots of people that are, you know, data wonks would love, that's what they do. They love to do that. But most of the time, we're trying to get data in the hands of community members. So we start to walk to and go to community-based organizational meetings. This Saturday, we will be at the Neighborhood Institute, which is being hosted by Strong City Baltimore. We will have an event in July called Baltimore Data Day, where we bring people together to train them on the information. But our staff is ready to go to attend your community meeting to show you what's in your community profile, and all 55 communities are available for people to look at.
Lynn has called us from Annapolis. Lynn, welcome to Midday.
Hi, thanks. I'll make this really short. I grew up in Baltimore. I love Baltimore. I live in Annapolis now, but I am in total agreement with everything that your guest is saying. It is spot on. I grew up in the 5200 block of Reisterstown Road in the house that my grandfather built, and we had a small family business there. For my family, my growing up I could walk to schools. Long walks, but good for me and my brother, and the grocery store, public libraries in the 50s, from my perspective in Baltimore, in that part of Baltimore, the bus system was fabulous. I chose to go to Western High School. It was downtown on Howard and Center Street. I had an hour and 45-minute bus ride. I was 13 years old, but I opted to go to Western. Everything was, it was happy, and it would be interesting to interview and recruit some folks like me who are older now and saw the best of Baltimore and would like to return. So that's all I want to say.
Lynn, I appreciate your calling. Some might listen to Lynn and say, okay, is the Baltimore Neighbors, the indicators that the BNI puts together, is this about nostalgia? Is this looking back to how great things used to be, and isn't it a shame that we're not there?
Absolutely not. It is absolutely meant to be actionable and thinking forward about where you want to go, and you want to keep track. But what the caller tells me is that, look, each one of our neighborhoods really does represent the context in which we all grow. And if that context is not healthy, we individually are going to be at a disadvantage of our own personal outgrowth. And so the context is something that we all need to be involved in, all neighborhoods, all city agencies. And it's just like if you're going to plant a seed, you need to know to make sure that the soil is correct. You still have to tend and you still have to garden, but our neighborhoods are truly our soil.
We don't have many minutes left. Michael is calling us from Baltimore. Michael, welcome to Midday.
Hi, thanks. I have a quick question about demolition and resale. And my question is just how long does it take for an abandoned or vacant property to be taken over by the government and demolished so that it can be, so that at least the plot can be resold to developers, anyone interested
Michael,
in?
I appreciate the question. I'm not sure it's in Seema's wheelhouse, but I'll ask her.
Yeah, well, we do have an indicator on our website called the demolition rate, and we've found that the number one kind of fastest route, and you know, if demolition is what the community wants to do, the fastest route is when the city actually owns the property itself. When ownership is clear and the city has owned it, then demolition. So if you look at our data, you can see where high demolition is exactly where the city has high ownership. The Poppleton, the Oliver East Green Mount East area, where you see a lot of demolition happening is where the ownership is very clear, and in this case, the clear ownership is the city. So take a look at those two indicators, and you can see how fast it might happen. Sandtown Winchester, for example, has extremely low city ownership of those properties. So if we do demolition there, that it could be a challenge based on ownership.
We have just a minute and a half left, and I have to ask you about a new indicator that you came up with. Public art per 1,000 residents is now a statistic?
Yes, absolutely.
Why?
We have been we always are trying to be on the prowl for indicators that are going to be actionable for neighborhoods. It has to be something you can do something about. And we know, based on, you know, obviously community-based work, that art, vitality, the things that we look at, the aesthetics, really do make our neighborhoods, and neighbors know this. And so we're trying to figure out quantifiable ways that we can think about the experiences that we all share in a neighborhood just because we happen to live there. And public art is one of those things. We're all looking at the same thing as we walk to school or kind of walk to the bus stop. And those things are always in our consciousness. And we have such a robust mural program in the city of Baltimore and a public art, the 1% for public art. And we worked with the Baltimore Office of Promotions to get this data for the city. So it's an indicator moving forward. That entire chapter, it's our arts and culture chapter, has got a lot of new work. We had a dedicated Baltimore Core Fellow and really excited about that.
Yeah, it's 1.2 pieces of
art
public
per capita. How does your neighborhood?
Residents. Thank you so much, Dr. Seema Iyer, Associate Director of the Jacob France Institute in the University of Baltimore's Merrick School of Business. Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much for...
Also want to thank Eddie's of Roland Park for providing lunch for our guest today. Eddie's is a full-service market with locations on North Charles Street and on Roland Avenue in Roland Park. Their deli features sandwiches, salads, specials each day, all listed on their website, eddiesofrolandpark.com. And thank you for listening. Tune in tomorrow for a conversation with Charles Bethay, the new chief curator for the Reginald F. Lewis Museum. He has declared 2016 the year of the black male. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay tuned now for Here and Now.
Midday is produced by Maureen Harvey and Andrea Appleton. The show is engineered by Luke Spicknall. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at WYPR.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.